This takes me back.
You must do it again.
I think probably not.
I quite agree.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 284 for the week of January 6, 2020. I am home base dirt, David T. Cole, and I'm here with undead lawyer, Sarah D. Bunting.
Objection, bleh, verruled.
Batgirl, Tara Ariano. And saucy nun, Nick Reinwell Jones.
You dunking your sausage in that vampire, homeboy?
Welcome to Extra Hot Great, a new year, a new Dracula of sorts. We're going to get into it first. If you hear some noise on Sarah's track, it's because there is construction going on next door to her. So we apologize, but there's also nothing we can do. So sorry on behalf of everyone. Everyone in this case includes Nick Reinwell Jones, our guest. Hello, Nick.
Hello. It is a pleasure to begin the new year with all of you.
Is it because we're here to talk about Dracula now?
Well, this is. I'm not going to say the lead up was a pleasure, but
this is not the Dracula Dave loves, the one that wants to corner the energy market. This is Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss's take on Dracula, which aired in Britain on three consecutive nights, and then Netflix had it all at once after that. So three long ass episodes that dropped over the weekend, and I have in my notes plot summary, then five question marks. I truly don't know where to begin. It's based on the novel, kind of. I mean, there are the shapes of things that you will remember, even if you haven't read the book. You only know Bram Stoker's Dracula, the movie. Some of that stuff is still there, but then liberties are taken. But I don't know why. There's this guy, Dracula. He's a vampire. There's this guy, Harker. He's a lawyer. He comes to help him buy some property. There's a voyage at sea. There's a lady named Mina for a while. There's a nun that at various points Dracula is telling his story to and Jonathan is telling his story to. And then we're in the present. Let's start here. Horror narratives, I would say, we can all agree, serve a number of artistic functions, obviously, titillate the senses, let the reader or viewer contemplate human frailty and mortality in a safely abstracted way, portray transgressive behaviors at a also safely metaphorical remove. In other words, that vampirism is queer has always barely been subtext, so what I would like to know is why do Gatiss and Moffat seem so proud of themselves for making it A, artless in this adaptation, and B, putting it in the first 3 minutes of the first episode? Nick, your thoughts.
Well, I'm so curious, just on a general level, is this something they wanted to do, or is this something someone put a gun to their head and said, you have 10 minutes to write this?
Yeah. Go. You mean the project? Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
The project in general, because like it doesn't feel like they have a passion for Dracula or for this. It feels like they're just busting out the same like flashy narrative tricks that they used in Sherlock, except applying it to this. And, you know, We're going to get into the Buffy use of Dracula later on, but I think like I kind of felt the same about both of them, in that like you have this great pop cultural well to draw from, and you are adding nothing new to. I mean, this one, yes, it adds new things to it, but not the new things that we would want to have added to it. Like, for example, I think if you're going to spend 4.5 fucking hours on Dracula, you could maybe get into the backstory of like, who's Vlad the Impaler? What's that? Right. Like the, why is he the way he is? Which this show literally never gets into. Mm-hmm. Instead, we have 1.5 hours on a ship and, you know, some chess playing and all of this randomness. But I will say, speaking as a writer, it's always good to have what they call an audience surrogate character, who sort of represents the audience. And this show does a great job of that, because the character representing the audience is all of those mangled people in boxes yelling, "Kill me!"
Oh, I have a question for, I'm going to turn it over to Sarah, because in terms of transgression, that's obviously where a lot of the force of gothic horror comes from. But I feel like these guys in adapting Dracula, like they really thought they were taking some risks. And yet we live in a post Hannibal, the TV series world. This did not do it for me. Sarah, you obviously covered that show a lot more intensely than I did. What were your thoughts, Ray, these two projects in comparison?
Hannibal didn't even come to my mind as a comparison, because that was artful and was saying something new about a character that is like braided into the cultural consciousness. Mm-hmm. Sherlock was the same. Nick, you need to repeat your tweet from last night that was like, great, this Dracula is basically everything that was the that was shitty about the last.
Yeah, especially like, yeah, the indulgent way that they started to go into Sherlock in the final few episodes, where it was just like, well, two things. Like, one, the constant like flashing back and forth. Like, as soon as you're in an interesting scene, let's just pull you back out of it to be, you know, in some kind of conversation or whatever. That's mostly what they do in the first two episodes. But then also the obsession with having like the super smart hero talk to the super smart villain, you know, across a thin barrier and be like, we're not so different, are we, the two of us? Like, we didn't get enough of that on Sherlock, apparently. So now we like get like 3 hours of it on Dracula. And I did say I was talking to a critic I know who reviews mostly horror stuff, and I was saying like I would not be surprised if they actually just like cut and pasted some leftover Sherlock Moriarty dialogue for Agatha and Dracula, because it is virtually the same.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me either. Like, I understand that there is difficulty in coming at a figure like this, like a narrative sort of titan, even though it's, you know, fictional. But then why do it?
Like, right, exactly.
It just seemed so obligatory. Very seldom was anyone having any fun. During that one scene, like, you know, naked Dracula and Nun Helsing talking to each other across the membrane of, I don't even know, legend, while there's a whole group of nuns just standing there like, ladies, run, like, take your ass to another country. No, it just doesn't make any sense. And these are like, this is a creative team that did, before they like stayed too long at the dance, they did a good job updating Sherlock and using modern technology and stuff like that. And there actually are ways. I mean, some of them that I could think of are Malick-y, and not everyone's going to be into that, but there are ways to come at this personage that are not this boring, like, let's make everybody gray and blotchy and let's have a bunch of semi cheap looking bat special effects. Like, a lot of it was just like, we all know the story. Why are we doing it this way? And if this is the only thing that you can come up with, why are you doing it at all? Do you not have enough money? It makes no sense.
Yeah, that was my feeling too. Like, when you're given this text, your options are do a faithful adaptation or come at it with a new idea. And this is neither. It's so frustrating to watch, because it just, the exercise of it is so joyless and uninteresting. Like, and yet there's so much of it just going.
Well, and I don't know if you guys felt this way, but like, I, you know, obviously in retrospect, I can definitely say I hate it, but in the course of watching it, I felt like, and this is also true of even some of like the shittier Sherlocks, like there's just enough of those like WTF moments to keep you hooked. Like in the second episode, the reveal of like, oh, like, you know, because you keep wondering, like, how did Agatha end up playing chess with Dracula? Oh, this is, you know, a dream, and she's really being held captive by him. That was kind of interesting. And then the, you know, reveal of it being modern day, which was like, that was one of those twists where it was like, wow, that worked great as a twist. And then because they did that twist, everything after that sucked.
That was exactly my feeling about it too. And I felt like that second episode where it was like the episode where they're on the ship and it's sort of like, it's almost a mystery, except then it's not, because we already know who the killer is. we're just watching to see if, you know, the other passengers are going to figure out who the killer is, even though it seems quite obvious. And then there's the mystery of like who's in cabin number 9 and all this stuff. Like that's that sort of gave it a new kind of energy. And then, yeah, I did have the same thing where it's like, and then all of a sudden it's present day and there's a helicopter and I was like, okay. And then right after that, I was like, oh no.
Like, I was like, oh, this is what you're doing with it? Oh, and also let's, you know, can't get enough of like guys in their 50s writing what they think 20-year-old club kids are like.
Yes. Oh. Lucy and those long, long sleeves at the club. Like, this poor 20-something actress didn't think to say, like, no one my age was going to wear this dress. Guys, please don't put me in this, please. Yeah. Dave, your thoughts?
Let the wide stick give you the edge. Speed Stick Super Dry Antiperspirant.
Dracula.
Oh, no. Best thing that's happened to it so far was that.
I think somewhere there's a BBC designer very pleased with the fact that the font he used had fang teeth descenders coming from a couple of the letters that look like fangs when you put them together.
Yeah.
This seemed very unnecessary, and I feel like they didn't really have a hook for what Dracula meant in this series.
Yeah.
You have, in the recent past, AIDS crisis Dracula.
Right.
This one seemed to be void of that part of the interpretation of Dracula, or that part of the formula of what Dracula means. And it just kind of felt at the end of it, they were going for like beats that seemed to work better in a like I felt like what they were going for would have been better served if they did 6 episodes of different times in Dracula's life. And then just had, you know, here is the bottle mystery episode on the ship, and then did 5 more of those. But if they were going to sort of go with the tack that they did, where Dracula is just this guy and he's just having trouble apparently dealing with death. Like, okay. Then, you know, go one way or the other. Either figure out what you're actually saying or don't say it and just have something more entertaining.
You had all summer.
Sherlock isn't, you know, like you look at Sherlock in season 1 and season 2 anyways, where they were just having fun with it and do that. Yeah. But Dracula instead of Sherlock, that would be fine. But they didn't. They really felt like they were saying something, but they weren't. And it really felt like they're too cool for school, you know, but they weren't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's nothing more gross than the dumb show that really thinks it's smart. Like, it just makes your skin crawl watching it because... It's not enjoyable for the viewer, and the smugness of the producers just wafts off it, and it's so off-putting. And the other thing that, in addition to Hannibal, that Dracula suffers by comparison to is The Witcher, which just dropped on Netflix 2 weeks before this, and is extremely dumb also, but is dumb fun that knows what it is, and is, you know, trying to... I think probably attract the same kinds that are looking for the same sort of violent, darkly lit special effects with vague accents that are kind of Romanian sounding. But The Witcher is just like so much more satisfying than Dracula, because Dracula is trying to make so many like grandiose points, but doing such a shitty job of it. Whereas The Witcher is just like, look, the spider with a human face, I'm going to kill it. Like, great. That's what I'm here for.
Yeah. Well, I think there's also a foundational problem that is not this project's fault with Dracula narratives, which is that this is your hero, but you have to treat him like the villain. Like, actually, it's 2020 or 2019, whatever, when this was made. You don't have to do anything. You can, I mean, they had a whole like series of novels and graphic novels about Moriarty, I'm pretty sure. Like, do whatever you want. Hannibal did this really well.
Yeah.
But it's like we're not endorsing what he is, but we're acknowledging that this is the charismatic dark star who needs to be at the center of the story. And whenever they tried to make it about Will sort of like breaking apart while he's trying to psychoanalyze Hannibal, then it's like, who cares? Like, we just want to look at Mads Mikkelsen preparing delicious people. And this is the same thing. Like, there was a throwaway joke about his having eaten Mozart that I was like, why didn't you just do that? Like 33 short films about people what got et by Dracula.
I like how he's basically Siler from Heroes in this interpretation.
Well, or Liv from iZombie.
I think there's this like allergy to seeming like you're okay with him killing people, but it's like, okay, we all know how an anti-hero operates in the fictional world. Just do that and stop trying to make us care about, like, Jonathan Harker. That actor has been in a lot of stuff I've watched. Like, he was on Ripper Street.
Yeah,
he's really good, but like, nobody cares. Mm-hmm. And also, you're no Keanu is not something I should be writing in my notes. It just isn't.
There's this throwaway line, like the first big zinger question is Agatha asking Harker if he had sex with Dracula. Like, how come this Dracula isn't about like gender roles or something like that, if you really want to put a stake in it, as it were, to connect it to something today?
Or consent, or hashtag me too Dracula.
Well, when you say throwaway, I think that's a lot of what Gatiss and Moffat do on Sherlock, which is like pick up this shiny toy and be like, hey, this is interesting, and then just like throw it away and it's never to be seen again. And then pick up another one and like, okay, you think they're gonna explore it and they don't. And like, having the teaser end on did you have sex with Dracula, and then nope, we're not going to explore that concept at all in this show, really. Yeah, that's a perfect example of what they do.
It is time to go around the dial. First up, Tara Ariano.
Our extra, extra hot, great supporters on Patreon got to hear us talking in our last episode about sports pitches inspired by the two scripted series based on women's athletics that premiered this week, Dare Me and Spinning Out. We will be talking about both of them. Sarah is going to be covering Spinning Out later in this segment. I will just briefly talk about Dare Me. This is the one that critics seem to be liking more. It's about cheerleading. It's on USA on Sunday nights. It's about a squad of cheerleaders that gets a new coach, and she has a dark past, and they all kind of have dark secrets too, of various kinds. They live in this town that's dying and that is hoping to get back on its feet by building a sports stadium. And there's a kind of weird story going on with that, with this coach that's just come to town and her husband and stuff. And a bunch of the kids from the high school are all getting recruited to join the military because that's their only chance to get out of town. So, you know, there's real stuff and real dark stuff. And as I watched the first episode, which I'm not saying it was bad, it's just really not for me, because though I am not a parent, I have learned that watching scripted shows about teenagers being bad is too stressful for me, and I don't enjoy it. I turned off the pilot of HBO's Euphoria last summer about 40 minutes in, and this thing seems like it's building to one or more people probably getting murdered. So for people who liked Pretty Little Liars but wished it had more of a Ken Loach feel, I would say Dare Me might be the show for you, plus cheerleading. Sunday nights on USA. Instead, I like my murders to be ridiculous, which is why I watched all of season two of You on Netflix very quickly. If you watch season one of You, it's about this guy, Joe, who is a love addict. That's putting it kindly. He gets obsessed with women and does all kinds of crazy shit and narrates the show from his fucked up psycho perspective. He's played by Penn Badgley from Gossip Girl. So after the end of season one, which I won't spoil, he had to leave New York, and now he's in L.A. He's focused on this new broad, Victoria Pedretti, who's from The Haunting of Hill House. Her name on this show is Love, and she has a twin whose name is 40. I'm sorry. I thought that was hilarious. Their parents own this store. It's called, oh, I'm not going to be able to say it right, but it's Nirvana backwards. It's obviously based on Erewhon, this real grocery store in L.A. So they're rich. The show mines all kinds of really funny stuff, very true things about L.A. There's been coverage about whether it's too mean to L.A., but like, having lived in New York and L.A., it's like, A, L.A. can take it. B, did you think that you liked New York or any of its characters, because no, like it's a very angry, bitter show. Like, you know, wherever it is, it's going to hate where it is. It's, you know, don't take it personally. That said, it also introduces a new character played by Chris D'Elia as this greasy, gross comedian who preys on young girls. It's like a very thin, thin gloss on what I imagine his character is like in reality. He's very well cast, and without spoiling anything, I appreciate where his arc went, and introduces two new characters who are neighbors of Joe, who also gets a new name this season. Who are great. They play sisters, Carmela Zimbardo and Jenna Ortega, who play Delilah and Ellie. Both fantastic, real breakout performances. And the funny thing about this show, too, as much as in season one, is just how much cops are not a factor at all. There's all kinds of machinations about like how you cover your tracks when you're essentially a serial killer. That evading discovery by police is not a part of it is very funny to me. So You is still silly. But it's much more fun to watch in its silliness. So I would much more highly recommend that if you find Dare Me too stressful. So
how dare you?
Thank you, Dave. For my plug, I have two things. Again with this, we will be reviewing the Vincent Young film vehicle, What Death Leaves Behind. This is a movie he's been plugging on Instagram for like 2.5 years. So I'm excited to see what all the fuss is about from him only. And as I mentioned in our last regular episode, I went on our friend Dave Chen's podcast, Culturally Relevant, to count down the top 10 TV episodes of the 2010s. And that is now up. So we will link it in the show notes. And that's it for me.
Mr. Nick, Rhinewell Jones.
I was alerted to the presence of Magic for Humans Season 2 by none other than Tara. And as we all know, it is often hard to know when things are happening on Netflix. I really don't think I would know that that was available if I hadn't heard it from you. So thank you. It is fantastic, just as Season 1 was. I think it's easy to take for granted how hard it is to do even a half-hour show that is nothing but magic tricks. And the way he does it with like his kind of, you know, affable host personality and each episode having a theme and all of like none of the magic really being mean to anyone or being like, I mean, it is flashy, but in a very, you know, casual way. It's, I mean, he's basically like an uncreepy David Blaine with what he does. And I also as an aside, it's really funny to go on Reddit or any place like that and read the comments about the magic in the episodes, because there are people saying one of two things: either that's impossible, he's just doing that with like CGI and camera tricks, or oh, that's not that hard to do at all. And it's like, well, okay, which is it? But I will say that I have seen him do magic in person, and if you get the chance to do that, absolutely you should. It's even better than the show, and the magic is even more impressive in real life than the stuff he does on TV. So I have no trouble believing that all the stuff on TV is real. He, you know, did things like he did some of the same things that he's done on the show, like getting someone's cell phone inside of a bottle, and it's really operating in there and stuff. He did one thing at the beginning of the show that was absolutely hilarious, which was it was something where, you know, someone had to like come up and like, you know, name a number that like he couldn't possibly have predicted before. And then he like opens a box and there's like a printed out thing of the number or the name or whatever it was. And he was like, how could I possibly have done that? And he's like, I know, maybe you're like skeptical and you're like, well, he probably has like a Bluetooth printer hidden inside that box. And he's like, well, okay. And he opens the box and there's a printer in it. But then he talks about it for a few minutes and then he like squashes the printer because it's just a paper like model of a printer. And there are like so many things like that. And his onstage personality is just as great. Obviously, like a little bit edgier on stage, but not like to a ridiculous degree. Not the way that like David Copperfield, if you ever see him live, like he's trying to be fucking Dane Cook up there with his stuff, and it's terrible. But Justin Willman is great. So
Magic for Humans, as his title would say, like it is more human than most other acts out there. Like there's a whole bit about experimenting with kids, whether they'd rather delay gratification to get something better or get something yes. now. But he does it within making things disappear and appear for kids and stuff like that. So it's more than just, you know, here's a flashy trick and how did I do it? Everything's couched in something else, which makes it, you know, entertaining if they can nail that other part of it.
And one other thing to mention, speaking of things that are hard to find on streaming, I wouldn't have known this unless I was just like a maniac randomly browsing the Amazon Prime app. But, Alana Glazer has a 1-hour comedy special on Amazon now that I just watched last night, and it is fantastic. It takes a little bit to get going, but, once she gets off on a topic, she's absolutely hilarious, as you would expect her to be. And, for plugs, if you live in Los Angeles and you are at all interested or open to immersive theater, I have a couple of shows opening in the next couple months. They're both remounts of stuff we did last year. One is called The Pod. It is a show for one person. It is sci-fi. It is about being sent on a simulation space mission with an artificial intelligent companion. And the other one is Safe House 82, which is an interactive spy thriller. We were lucky enough to get featured on a KCRW show here in Los Angeles about nice. That was cool, and hopefully gives us a little more exposure, but I will throw up some links there if anyone is interested.
I got two questions for you on this.
Yes.
What if you don't live in LA but you just want to come anyways? Is that okay, or do you have to be from LA?
We will stop. We will check your real ID at the okay. door.
And two, this AI from The Pod, did you build a robot mm-hmm. for it? And can I have sex with the robot as part of your immersive theater?
We know people are going to ask that. You cannot have sex with the robot.
There's a 7 show. There's an 8 show. There's a 9 show. There's not time to clean all that between. So I get it. Sarah D. Bunting.
Okay, so yes, Spinning Out. This is the figure skating option. It dropped on Netflix, I guess, like a week ago. If you threw Black Swan, The Cutting Edge, and if anyone else remembers the Drew Barrymore, Chris O'Donnell feature, Mad Love.
Sure.
I do. Didn't see it, but
why?
I remember.
Please stop remembering it immediately. any hoodle, if you threw all those in a blender, you would get this. January Jones is perfectly cast as the skating mom who's like a little too intense. And it's a weird thing. Like, if you haven't watched it yet, like the first half, I watched the whole series. It's 10 episodes. The first half is like, there's some like cool behind the scenes processy stuff. And like Johnny Weir shows up and you're like, hey. But then the back half is terrible. It's like they stopped caring about basic timeline integrity. There's a reveal involving the central character's name is Kat, which is short for Katarina Witt, one assumes. I'm not sure who her sister Serena is named for, but there's a reveal involving her that is really cheap. They like one day before sectionals, all this shit is happening. It was like there was 38 hours in this one day. The presence of Johnny Weir just makes you sad that Be Good Johnny Weir isn't still on. I mean, I'm sad about that like weekly anyways. There's like the exposition is very clunky. Amanda Zhu is really good as Kat's best friend, Jen, but they don't take enough advantage of her or really like get into her story except as it's relating to or reflecting Kat. And the whole, you know, pun in the title is that Kat has bipolar. And so Spinning Out, but then as usual on TV, like she, it's like the characters don't watch TV and have never seen what this looks like on TV because she's, you know, she's being classic like TV manic episode and no one notices for like a month. I'm like, can we... I don't regret watching the whole thing, but it's not good. And at the same time, like the first half is actually a lot better than the second half. But once you've watched the first half, you might as well keep going. I don't know, like a try it. The first episode is like, it should tell you if you want to keep going. It's not necessary, but it was like crappy and enjoyable. It was frustrating, but I also was not bored. So yeah, spinning out. For my plug, quite a bit different tone. Surviving R. Kelly Part 2, The Reckoning, dropped a few days ago as you're listening to this from Lifetime. I wrote about it for Primetimer. There will be a link in the show notes. And I'm also talking about it with Mark Blankenship on The Blotter Presents, my true crime podcast this week that will have dropped by the time you're listening to this.
Are you like me, rewatching Frasier? I have a suggestion that you can spice up your Frasier rewatch. You watch an episode of Frasier, but then at the end, you talk over the last line of the song and you insert a different conspiracy theory right at the end. So it'll go something like this.
But I got you pegged. But I don't know what to do with those tossed salads and scrambled eggs.
Jet fuel can't melt steel beams.
I was hoping it would be that one.
The ominous backwards music means it is time for the No Neck, the evil goateed sinister twin of the canon, talking about a bad, bad episode of an ordinarily quality show. Nick Reinwell-Jones is presenting the case this week. Take it away, Nick.
Okay, well, since I knew that we were going to be covering Dracula this week, and I was thinking about what No Neckable episodes might be flapping around, shall we say, I thought of Buffy versus Dracula, which is season premiere of episode or season five of Buffy. And I don't think I've rewatched Buffy a lot of times. I don't think I had revisited this one more than once, and certainly not in several years. So I watched it to see if it was no-neck material, and boy, was it. So here we go. As we've already seen this week, there are many ways to approach the Dracula mythology in modern storytelling. I wrote that sentence before actually watching the Gatiss and Moffat Dracula, so now I can adjust it to, as we've already seen this week, there are many bad ways to approach the Dracula mythology. But anyway, Dracula is a tale based on lore and legend that had already been twisted and turned in a million directions before Bram Stoker got his hands on it. It is so well known, so ubiquitous in our culture, that there are countless choices you can make as to how to represent it, how to tweak it, how to present an original take on it, or you can do what this particular episode does and make absolutely none of those choices, resulting in one of the weakest season premieres in Buffy the Vampire Slayer history, which, as we all know, is saying a lot. Buffy vs. Dracula came on the heels of the season 4 finale Restless, which was poignant, funny, creepy, and groundbreaking. Everything people have praised this series for being, but this episode is none of those things. It's a stilted hour of TV that tries to fuse the well-worn mythos of Dracula with what at this point was in the series the pretty well-worn mythos of the Buffyverse, and does no favors to either of those properties. We'll get into some of the details of why this is such a dud, but first I want to talk about some of the behind-the-scenes stuff that informs this episode and the show in general. And I want to thank you all in advance for the opportunity to get into the weeds on TV staffing decisions, because there aren't a lot of places where I can do that without someone telling me, sir, this is Arby's. So I want to talk about that right away, because the very first scene in this episode highlights a major behind-the-scenes change that happened between seasons 4 and 5. So, for the first 4 seasons, Sarah Michelle Gellar's stunt double was a British woman named Sophia Crawford, and in the second season, Crawford's husband, Jeff Pruitt, was brought on as the stunt coordinator. They were both very talented and worked great together, and the fight scenes on Buffy in seasons 2, 3, and 4 were almost always fantastic, even in otherwise lackluster episodes. At the end of the fourth season, Sophia Crawford and Jeff Pruitt both left the show. It was strongly rumored at the time that their departure was due to personality conflicts with Sarah Michelle Gellar, but regardless of the reason, the quality of Buffy's fight scenes was never the same after they left. On another series, that might be a minor issue, but I would argue that the execution of the on-screen combat was really important to buying into the reality of Buffy's Slayer abilities and the idea that she was always in real danger when she was fighting. When the quality of the stunt work took a hit, no pun intended, and you started to notice the seams, the show became a little less magical. And like I said, that is evident right from the opening minutes of this show. We see Buffy racing through the graveyard to slay yet another vampire, but instead of being smooth and precise and edited in long takes like the fight scenes used to be, this one is chopped up within an inch of its life, so rapid fire that it's hard to even follow the action. And the individual fighting moves are needlessly flashy, somewhere between pro wrestling and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. In general, it just feels wrong enough to start both the episode and the season on the wrong foot. All right. After the opening theme song, which remains fantastic, You would be wise to keep your eyes on the bottom of the screen to see who wrote this episode. Also, if you're looking down, you'll be spared from seeing the first and only beach scene that this show ever did. So, yes, Buffy vs. Dracula was written by Marty Noxon, who is a famously divisive figure among Buffy fans. And let me just say, she deserves credit for a number of things. She's absolutely a talented writer. She co-created Unreal, was the showrunner for the first season. She recently adapted Sharp Objects for HBO. She's been very, very successful in television. And as far as I can tell from seeing her interviewed, she seems like a delightful person. And she is hilariously self-aware of her standing in the Buffy fandom. Her Twitter bio reads, and I swear I'm not making this up, "I ruined Buffy and I will ruin you too." Now, I don't think she actually ruined the show, but I do think that she saw Buffy the Vampire Slayer in some fundamentally different ways than Joss Whedon and the other writers saw it. And because of that, a lot of the episodes she wrote pulled the show too far into soap opera territory, which is basically what this episode is, or tries to be. It's a soap opera about Buffy being drawn toward Dracula, yet another vampire who's bad for her, and how she's unable to resist his charms even when her life is in danger. And in a choice that may or may not have been purposely meta, Dracula is played by Rudolph Martin, an actor who had not only spent 2 years acting on the soap opera All My Children, but had actually acted on that soap opera alongside Sarah Michelle Gellar. You might think that all this would translate into the characters slash actors having decent chemistry with each other, but you would be wrong. Let's take a listen to their first scene together.
Who are you?
I apologize. I assumed you knew. I'm Dracula.
Get out! So let me get this straight. You're Dracula. The guy, the Count.
I am.
And you're sure this isn't just some fanboy thing? Because I fought more than a couple pimply, overweight vamps that call themselves Lestat.
You know who I am. As I would know without question that you are Buffy Summers.
You've heard of me.
Naturally. You are known throughout the world.
Nah. Really?
Why else would I come here? For the sun? I came to meet the renowned killer.
Yeah, I prefer the term slayer. You know, killer just sounds so...
naked?
Like I paint clowns or something. I'm the good guy, remember?
Perhaps, but your power is rooted in darkness. You must feel it.
All right, I promise I won't make you listen to too many clips because it's hard to find a lot of memorable ones, even memorably bad ones. But this exchange definitely illustrates a lot of what is confounding about this episode. First of all, why is Buffy surprised that she's famous among vampires? Way back in season one, the Master knew all about her, and he's the guy that had every vampire in the world on a group text. Angel knew about her. Spike knew about her. In fact, in the final episode of this very season, she fights a vampire who doesn't recognize her, and she specifically says that it's been a long while since she fought one and didn't know her. Make up your fucking mind. Lord knows this series contradicted and retconned itself plenty of times, but this is a pretty fundamental fact that is either forgotten or ignored just long enough for us to laugh at Buffy's blushing schoolgirl reaction to Dracula. And let's be clear, Dracula does not deserve this reaction. Nothing about the way he's portrayed here, the way he's written, or the performance has anything approached the amount of gravitas or sexiness that you'd want the character to have, both for your experience watching him as a viewer and for your ability to buy into Buffy's attraction to him. I know this was not filmed for high def, but watch again high def, the makeup and wig make him look less like a badass interpretation of Dracula and more like the Joker trying to disguise himself as a member of Steely Dan. Anyway, bottom line, Dracula is a character that looms large in pop culture and specifically among vampires, and is obviously a big choice to bring him into the Buffyverse. It's not something you write on the back of a TGI Fridays napkin after you sucked all the Jack Daniel's sauce off your happy hour wings. And let me clear, playing Dracula solely for laughs would have been a totally valid option. In fact, the idea of Dracula showing up in Sunnydale and actually being far less of a big deal than he expected could have been an interesting and funny premise of the kind that the show did when it was on fire. We do get a hint of that in our second clip, in which Riley, yes, we still have to deal with Riley at this point in the series. We haven't even gotten to Dawn yet, Jesus Christ. But anyway, this is where Riley goes to Spike for advice about Dracula.
What can you tell me about Dracula?
Dracula.
Fancy bugger owes me £11 for one thing.
You know him?
Know him. We're old rivals. But then he got famous and forgot all about his foes. I'll tell you what. That glory hound's done more harm to vampires than any slayer. His story gets out, and suddenly everybody knows how to kill us.
Yep. The mirror bit. But he's not just a regular vampire. He has special powers, right?
Nothing but showy gypsy stuff. What's it to you, anyway?
He's in town, making his presence known.
Drax in Sunnydale, eh? I guess the old boy needed closure after all.
Actually, he's gunning for Buffy. But I'm out to find him before he gets another shot at her.
Tough talk, cowboy. But you're not going to catch him napping in a crypt. No, the Count has to have his luxury estate and his bug eaters and his special dirt, doesn't he?
All right, first of all, we do need to talk about how much of the humor in this episode is problematic. We have the punching down bullying stuff like Buffy's line about Pimperly overrate vampires, or Spike's line here where he refers to Dracula as a, quote, poncy bugger, which is just a British way of saying something wildly homophobic. Meanwhile, the rest of the jokes in this hour are mostly ripoffs of other jokes. For example, the bit about Dracula owing Spike money, which I'm very sorry to say requires me to say the words Kevin Smith in that order on a podcast hosted by my good friends. But still, the joke is lifted almost word for word from a line that Chris Rock's character has in the movie Dogma. And okay, we're done talking about K blank S blank. If anyone needs aftercare, let me know. But also, the other big quote unquote laugh line in this episode comes much later when Giles is taken by Dracula's trio of seductresses, which you can either take as a loving homage to Monty Python and the Holy Grail, or if you're feeling less charitable, which I obviously am, you can say is just a pathetic bit of pandering to one of the biggest joy buzzers in the nerd humor catalog. Anyway, Spike's complaint about Dracula's fame being the bane of his existence is the one genuinely funny moment in this entire hour, so props to that. And also, boy, we could have used a lot more Spike in this episode. But hey, who needs Spike when you have lots and lots of Riley, I ask, with the heaviest of sighs. There's nothing to say about the plot of Buffy versus Dracula, really, because it very much does not have one. We're just twiddling our thumbs, waiting for Buffy to actually kill him, which of course she does in the most boring way possible, and also in a way that undercuts any genuine threat Dracula might have posed. It, I will say, has that in common with the other Dracula show that we watched this week. But I mean, again, if you're going to bother bringing Dracula into this show, why not go whole hog and have an enjoyably tense scene where Buffy has to stake him the traditional way while he's asleep in the coffin? Or it could also have been interesting if the writers let Dracula be the vamp that got away and used that as the launching point for an exploration of the darker side of Buffy's instincts, which is something they talk a lot about doing in this episode, exploring the, you know, that her power is rooted in darkness, but they never actually do. And that is a sin that extends far beyond this particular hour. This episode writes exactly one interesting check, and it is a check that the rest of the season cannot remotely cash. So, for everything this episode is and everything it is not, Buffy vs. Dracula deserves to be buried in the dirt-filled coffin of the Nonak, never to be seen again except when you're scrolling past it on Hulu on your way to one of the two or three actually good episodes in the fifth season. Thank you, and blah.
Sarah, why don't you go first?
First of all, apologies. They are apparently excavating Dracula and all his minions from the sub-basement next door. I feel like generally this one is like, this is a bad episode for all the reasons that Nick enumerated. Excellent presentation. But that, like, Buffy did not hold up very well for me when I did a rewatch a few years ago. And like with every successive rewatch of a given episode or series of episodes, it loses a little bit of fizz. But this is noticeably poor and squanders a lot of opportunities. The wig on Dracula is just like risible, and it just kind of ruins the entire illusion.
But also the white makeup on his face that doesn't go down his neck.
Yeah, like it's gray and then it's beige, like there's a line, like Trump style. Riley, like, I won't defend Riley and the way he was written, but I always felt bad for Mark Blucas, because there were so many things about that whole arc that weren't thought out, and then they would try to dig themselves out of it and they would fall in deeper. But the whole, like, again, Buffy's power is rooted in darkness and she needs to explore that, and she needs to be able to sit with the conflict. Da, 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 da. Like, they just never quite got it. Mostly though, this episode is bad because things that were familiar and beloved about the show in season 3 have now become tics in season 5. Halting cutesy Willow over it. Xander being the butt of, like, he has a whole speech about it that really falls flat because we all know that, you know, him being a butt boy will actually continue. Added to that is knowing about Nicholas Brendan's IRL struggles, which, like, it doesn't help. And then he's wearing a Hawaiian shirt that has, like, sequins on it, which I don't understand at all. Emma Caulfield, like, I don't, this was an era on the show when the actresses were in need of a sandwich, and I will just leave it there. That was much too much sternum for me. But the real problem with this episode is that it's 33 minutes of material that, instead of sitting down and being like, we are dealing with Dracula, we need to pack this season premiere to the rafters with stuff. They were like, we have 33 minutes. We're just going to stretch it to 43 and then have this cliffhanger at the end with Dawn. No good. Like, it's just a C minus. Like, it's not even flagrantly bad enough to piss me off. I was just like, wow, what a waste. Like, and just within scenes, like, can we just edit this so that it resembles a conversation people who have met before would be having with each other? And just like the runner with Giles being about to leave and Willow's like, but I need you. Like, oh my fucking God, we got it. Yeah, the episode is bad, but unfortunately, I feel like for me, Buffy hasn't stayed like good enough that this for season five is that much worse or that much more frustrating than other episodes of the show in this era. So I got to think about it. I'm looking forward to hearing what other people have to say and also to going mute because this grinding must be driving all of you crazy. Tara.
Thank you for Nick for bringing up the behind the scenes stunt drama, because I remember that happening, and I remember a story that went up that was like a very, very lightly veiled version of like the drama that was told in fairy tale format, where Sarah Michelle Gellar was like the princess at the time. So that was fun to remember because I did certainly notice that the editing on the fight scenes was bad, but I didn't remember when this happened in terms of the changeover. So thank you for that history lesson. It's important for the children to know. This was, for me, I agree with Sarah that Buffy hasn't held up for me as well as some other shows of the time. But for me, this really was extremely bad. I mean, I remember too how much this was plugged that whole summer, that this was going to be like Buffy versus Dracula. Finally, the vampire show is doing Dracula, the one vampire everyone knows. This is going to be it. Big deal. And then when you get to it, it's so flat. And like the non-Dracula parts are so strange. I mean, not to short circuit Dave's comments, but when it starts, he was like, this feels like 90210, that beach scene. And it does. It's so strange and off tone.
Yeah. Like, let's spend 5 minutes on that when we have a Dracula episode.
And then like the rest of it, it's so slow. It's so slow. And the scene where Buffy actually drinks Dracula's blood, like, for how much filler there has been for the whole rest of the episode, like, nothing that leads up to that feels earned for what a big moment that actually is. And then she just drinks and is like, eh, like, what? What just happened? Like, none of the storytelling hangs together or logically proceeds in a way that makes any sense. And then when she actually does stake him, and then he comes back to life, and then she's like, I've seen your movies, and stakes him again. And then he's like, starts to coalesce again. And she's like, I'm standing right here. Like, what are we doing? Like, what is actually happening here? How many minutes short were you that we're watching this fucking vaudeville routine? Like, this is Abbott and Costello level comedy. I mean, it's so dumb. And the most tragic part of it is seeing the good actors try to do what they can to make it work. Like when Riley pulls Giles out of the hole and he's like, oh, my shoe. Like, you know, I laughed. It was cute because Anthony Stewart Head is like talented and funny. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say Sarah Michelle Gellar's hair doesn't look great, because it does. But of course, this is such a yawn. And you're so right that, like, it's just such a missed opportunity. And in terms of, like, the sexiness of Dracula, especially, like, this guy is way less sexy even than Claus Bang from the other Dracula we watched this year.
A slight step above the master in terms of fuckability.
No kidding. So yeah, for me, this is in terms of, like, where it aimed and where it fell. This is no neck worthy for me. So Dave, what do you think?
The capper to the Dracula comes back three times thing is that they ask her, "What happened to Dracula?" And she answers, "Euro trashed," which falls like, what a clunker. But also, like, what exactly is the fate of Dracula? Like, he's still around. You just stake him, and apparently you can't kill him. Does he come back in the series? He doesn't, right?
Oh, no.
Really weird ending that was like, yeah, I killed Dracula, and I stopped his weird second life attempt, and then this bad joke. But it seemed all for naught. Like, they just basically bought some time, except they didn't, because he never comes back. Confusing. This is me. You can't see it, but I got my hands up with question marks above my head.
Yeah.
Also, why does Dracula, who transforms into a wolf and a bat, sound like a cat while he's fighting in the big end fight scene? Like, he actually has, like, jaguar noises. Interesting choice. Judging by his fashion, Dracula last was, like, roaming the earth during 1976, because he's got, like, his whole getup is wide collar disco sort of red stemware inspired like leisure suit kind of.
Yeah, the red shirt with the black vest is pure Larry from Three's Company.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. The one part that I enjoyed, only because my mind sort of floated out of my head and was like making up a new direction for the episode, is at the beginning when Dracula first turns into a bat, flies around everybody for a moment just to irritate them. They got me thinking, like, what if the story of this episode is Dracula letting his true self out? That he's just like a really obnoxious frat jerky bro who wants to bro down in SoCal. And that's like his first.
Chadula.
Exactly. Like, that episode that I started to form and create and write as the rest of the episode was going on was kind of entertaining. Unfortunately, not the one we got. There's also a very bad beach rain effect when Dracula's presence is first coming. It's just like a 2D overlay over what they shot on a very, very sunny day at Santa Monica Pier. It was kind of funny.
It looked like it came out of a Harryhausen.
Not even that, because, like, the Harryhausen stuff is jilted but well-defined. This was blurry in a very, you know, CG of its time, or even just, like, an overlay or something they put on. It was just bad. I will give them props for knowing who the best Dracula was when Buffy says this during the final fight.
A guy like you should think about going electric. Seriously.
Good advice. The low effort of this episode overall, I believe, one thing I caught is demonstrated by their use of the Apple Loops default sound set that you get with GarageBand or Logic or whatever. Here is the opening scene where two guys, the movers, are lugging the home turf dirt around, and we hear this as Dracula's arm pops out and grabs one of them. Here is the effect that I just ripped from Apple Loops, free with GarageBand.
Wow.
Oh, man, guys.
All right, you convinced me. We can vote now.
But that just made me realize, though, that the end of season four, beginning of season five, was also when they lost Chris Beck as the composer of the show.
Right.
So it was like, yep, let's just have some shitty music to send him off to.
It's literally called Suspense Accent Number 7.
So. Wow. Lucky number 7.
Also, like, Dracula is so low energy. Like, he doesn't feel like a foe worthy of Buffy. I feel like they should have aged him up. Like, there's this whole thing about, is Giles still Buffy's watcher because, like, Buffy has outgrown him? Like, she knows what she's doing now. She doesn't need his help. And then, like, Dracula supposedly comes in to shake up that notion that Dracula really understands the dark side of being a slayer and blah, blah. And now she needs the watcher's help to guide her through what's coming next. Like, they should have made Dracula a little older to be basically kind of like sexy Giles. I think that would have worked better.
Huh. It's interesting.
And then also have like somebody who can actually add a little something to it, because it's really like it's the most exciting thing in the world. Like, you know, I just won the lottery. Like, okay, way to bring it, Dracula. Like, that's, it's just weird choices all around. And it just, like, it falls flat, but it also falls flat in a way that you see the potential and what they could have done with Buffy versus Dracula. Because as Nick said, or Sarah said, this is like fucking head honcho numero uno vampire. And this is the episode you build. This is not as bad as Amends, which is the current Buffy Nonak entry, but it is really bad. Like, Amends is bad concept, bad execution. This is bad execution on what should have been a decent, if not like duh, concept that Buffy would eventually go up against Dracula. But it was just like disappointing stem to stern.
So, yep.
All right. So let's put this to a vote. Sarah D. Bunting, have you made up your mind?
I have. And thank you, Tara, for reminding me how heavily they promoted this and how flat it fell. That and the crappy sound cue definitely helped me make up my mind. This is a yes for the Nonak from Buncey.
Tara Ariano?
Same.
Yeah,
definitely. So...
Oh, okay, buddy.
That means that Buffy season 5 episode 1, Buffy versus Dracula, you are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Nonak.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for winner and loser of the week. Sarah has the winner.
Well, the winner is Sarah, because you went back to the old Nonak music. Thank you for that. Happy New Year to me. The actual winner is Killing Eve, which got an early season 4 pickup before season 3 has even premiered. So good for them. I'm not sure how long I'm going to stick around. They got a lot of clawing back to do, but good for them. I hope they can do it.
And loser of the week is from Nick.
Yes. So we were just talking about The Witcher, and so was some asshole who I don't even know his name, but he's a host of a show from The Daily Wire, which, as we all know, The Daily Wire is one of the main sources of toxic fake news bro-y bullshit in this world. And
Ben Shapiro's website.
Yes. And this was not Ben Shapiro doing the rant, but someone, you know, just as bad as him, saying that The Witcher is terrible because women could not really fight like swords or fight with swords like that in real life. That's ridiculous. It's not believable. He's checked out. And so a female fantasy author named Samantha Shannon quote tweeted his rant with her own rant and said, I'll read some of it. She said, "I almost want to thank this man for providing a flawless example of how the notion of quote unquote accuracy is used selectively and insidiously in fantasy. It's okay for men to do the impossible, but not women. It's not real, Andrew. I don't know how to explain this to you. I take issue with the idea that women can't fight with swords, but even if that were the case, it's a fantasy. I don't know how certain male critics can suspend their disbelief about everything but the strength of a woman in a genre that regularly explores the impossible. Dragons? Fine. Men who fight beasts? That's okay. It's fantasy. But a female character fighting with a sword? That's always one step too far. How dare a woman stand there with a sword, not wearing armor molded to her breasts, not serving drinks, or being sexually assaulted?"
Yeah.
Yeah, girl. So,
yeah.
Speaking of serving drinks?
Speaking about things that women do poorly, do you know what time it is?
Sword time?
Man, this has been an interesting season to date. This is the sixth game time, and the scores are Sarah in the lead with 3, Value Guess with 2, and Tara with 0 still. Tara, what's up?
I don't know.
Yeah. Today we are playing Televisual Pursuit from Rebecca, who earns herself an extra credit topic of her choosing. She writes, inspired by the cards used in the Gross Worth Equalizer Challenge, this game is a riff on Trivial Pursuit. How well do you know the geography, entertainment, history, arts and literature, science and nature, and sports and leisure of your favorite TV shows? Let's find out. 1 point for every question you need to answer, except for the history category. She sent everything but history and science, and I thought, if we don't have all 6 categories, it's really going to bother me. So I did the history and science ones, and the history category is a little bit different. So okay. Apologies if mine aren't up to snuff, but I felt like we needed to have all 6, or the mind goblins would have gotten me.
Of course.
Tara Ariano, can we please have the steel meal situation?
Certainly, Dave. Sarah D. Bunting has 1 steel meal. I have 2 steel meals plus an extravaganza gong. Mm-hmm. And the valued guest has 6 steel meals.
Oh, wow.
All right. Remember, if you need to use that steel meal, you have to shout steel meal very quickly after somebody gives the incorrect answer to steal a chance for those points.
Be aggressive.
Yes.
May I ask what the extravaganza gong is?
When nobody knows.
You can ask.
And you can only use it when given the opportunity. So it's not like an open-ended.
It's like the law of surprise. Okay.
Yeah. Last time it was the option to tag team on a whole game against Tara. But it's not the same every time. So you never know until it happens. Mm.
I think I used that and still lost. So good luck.
You didn't use it and lost. Oh, that was your big mistake. You did not tag team. You went solo.
Oh, yeah. That was my big mistake.
Yeah. All right, let's throw it to Thicky to see who is going first.
We will start with Tara.
All right, we'll start with Tara and then we'll go Sarah, then Nick. Are we ready to play Televisual Pursuit?
Yes.
You bet.
All right. We're going to start off with the first category on the Trivial Pursuit card, which, of course, is the blue category, geography. In this round, I will give you the name of fictitious town where a show is set. You name the show for 1 point. We'll go fast because these are pretty well known for the most part. I think this game is going to be decided in the couple that you get wrong. So here we go. Tara Ariano, Stars Hollow.
Gilmore Girls.
Sarah D. Bunting, Cape Side.
Dawson's Creek.
Nick. Reinwell Jones. Hawkins.
Oh, shit. Well, Hawkins. Supernatural?
That was Stranger Things.
Right.
Oh.
Back to Tara. Dylan.
Oh, Friday Night Lights.
Sarah D. Bunting. Pawnee.
Parks and Rec.
Nick Reinwell Jones. Sunnydale.
Finally, picky. Buffy.
I think I said Sunnyvale during the no neck thing. I always get confused which one's real and which one's a made up one. Tara Ariano, Sicily.
Northern Exposure.
Sarah D. Bunting, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Bontom.
Bontemps, True Blood.
Correct. Nick Ridewell Jones. You may have not got the first one, but picky really knows you here on out. Neptune.
Veronica Mars.
Tara Ariano, Storybrooke.
Once Upon a Time.
Sarah D. Bunting, Charming California.
Charming California?
Yes.
The other one that was sort of like Once Upon a Time, which was... not Rain. God damn it.
I'll put you out of misery because you're not on the right track.
Steel Mill.
Steel Mill from Tara.
Is it Sons of Anarchy?
It is.
Wow, I really was stolen away.
Yeah. Last question of round one geography for Nick. Cabot Cove.
Murder, She Wrote.
That is correct. So let's get the scores, please, Tara, after 1 round.
Okay. I have 5. Sarah and Nick are tied with 3 each.
All right. Let's get back to it with round 2, the pink category, entertainment.
Excellent.
In this round, I will give you the name of a fictional TV show or movie from within a real show. You name the real show.
Okay.
Tara. Vidas del Fuego.
Jane the Virgin? Shit.
Incorrect.
Steel Mill.
Steel Mill from Nick.
Nick said Steel Mill.
I know.
30 Rock.
I can hear. Incorrect. Ugh. That was Ugly Betty.
Oh.
Sarah D. Bunting. Your fake show within a real show, MILF Island.
MILF Island.
Yes. MILF Island.
I'm going to be mad when this is wrong. 30 Rock again?
It is. Yeah. 30 Rock. Nicholas Reinweldian Jones. Inspector Spacetime.
Oh, Community.
Community, correct. Tara. Defamation.
Dear White People?
This is question 17 for Sarah.
Spread Eagle.
Spread Eagle.
The show, The Valley.
The Valley.
Valley is a fake show.
The OC? I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nick Reinwell Jones, your show is Due North.
I don't know.
That is Insecure. Soap opera from Insecure. This is question 19. It is for Tara.
Yep.
Darkness at Noon.
The Good Wife.
Correct. Sarah D. Bunting. All My Circuits.
All My Circuits.
Yeah, this is definitely a Sarah D. Bunting blind spot.
Futurama?
Yes, man.
I was going to say, that's a hint.
Thanks for the hint.
That's 3 for 3 on your wild guesses. Well done.
Yep. Yeah.
Nick, Le Cousins Dangereux.
Arrested Development.
Yes. Everybody's last question of the entertainment round coming at you. Clash of the Cupcakes, Tara.
Oh, fuck. Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
That's Steel Mill. Steel Mill from Nick.
Master of None.
Yes.
Oh.
Nice. Sarah D. Bunting, your fake show within a real show. Pucks, as in hockey pucks.
Pucks?
Yes.
Benson?
Incorrect. That was...
You got 4 Steel Meals, Nick.
Steel Meal. Okay. Episodes.
Correct. Nick, here's your real question. Rochelle, Rochelle.
Seinfeld.
Seinfeld, correct. All right, let's get the scores, and then we're going into our first Equalizer Challenge Zone.
All right. Nick is in the lead with 8. I have 7. Sarah, 6.
Ooh, all right, guys. It's time for...
me.
Now, before you get all set up, here's how it's working, because we're already playing a game that is Trivial Pursuit, so I feel like we shouldn't just play these cards as we usually do. So here's how it's going to work. Tara, Sarah, you're working together, and if you get all the requisite questions right, we subtract from Nick.
Oh.
So here we go. Are you ready?
Savage.
Tara and Sarah.
Yes.
Who became Johnny Carson's announcer on Who Do You Trust in 1958?
Probably Ed McMahon.
Yeah, gotta be McMahon.
Correct.
Yeah.
That was classics, by the way. Sorry about that. Sitcoms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which two beer bottle cappers on Happy Days got their own sitcom?
Laverne and Shirley.
Yes.
Drama. What movie won the head-to-head ratings battle in 1979? Elvis, Gone with the Wind, or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? Oh, sorry. Elvis, exclamation point. I mean, it's not Elvis. It's Elvis.
Got it. Probably Gone with the Wind, right?
Yeah.
Gone with the Wind is incorrect.
Duh.
It was Elvis.
Elvis.
Kids and Games. Need one more to take 2 points off Nick's total.
Got it.
What show experimented with a female clown named Sarah Bell?
Howdy Doody.
I like how they said experimented. Like, oh boy.
Yeah,
I mean, having just watched The Boys from Brazil last night, that feels very ominous. So I'm going to not think about what Dr. Mengele might have been doing with Sarah Bell. Sure, I don't have another answer, so.
Okay. Howdy Doody is, in fact, correct. And there
we did it.
Last question, victory points. So now, updated scores. Nick just lost 2 points.
All right. So now Sarah and Nick are tied with 6 points each. I have 7.
Back to it. This is round 3 history. This is the one that has a slightly different point system. In this round, I will give you the synopsis of an episode from an alternative history TV show. You name the show. I'm going to give you 2 points if you name it after the synopsis, and 1 point if you can name it after a metadata clue. You can answer on both parts of the hint structure. Tara.
Yep.
This episode is called Hollywoodland. When a Rittenhouse sleeper agent in 1941 Hollywood steals the only copy of Citizen Kane, Lucy, Wyatt, and Rufus team up with Hedley Lamarr to get it back.
Timeless?
Timeless is correct. 2 points.
Wow.
Sarah D. Bunting, your episode is called Last Days. The title group name redacted, big clue. The group name redacted arrive in a world where an asteroid is about to collide with Earth and end all life. Unfortunately, they are stuck in this world for 72 hours. Professor Arturo may be the only one who can save them and this Earth.
And this Earth?
This Earth.
Well, it's not this, but why not guess it anyway? The Lone Gunman.
That's what I was thinking too.
Here is your metadata clue. This was season 1, episode 3. It is from 1995. And one of the stars of this show is John Rhys Davies, a.k.a. Sala from Raiders. And that guy from Lord of the Rings. Whose name I forget. I always wanted to call him Gummy, but it's not Gummy. Something like that. Gimli?
Gimli.
Yeah.
95,
yeah.
Shit. I have absolutely no idea.
Steam
for 1 point.
Sliders.
Sliders is correct.
Oh, yeah.
Nick, here is your full question. The episode is called Pursuit. After finding no Cape Kennedy in 1969 and no United States either, Phineas and Jeffrey return to the end of World War II to make sure that German rocket scientist Werner von Braun doesn't fall into Soviet hands.
This sounds like one of these animated shows that I do not watch. So I could take a guess, or
no penalty
I could,
for taking a guess.
Yeah. Okay. Adventure Time?
Incorrect. Here is your metadata clue. This was season 1, episode 16. It aired 1983.
Oh.
Starred John Eric Hexum.
All right. Wow. No idea.
I will also give you the extra clue. This is one of the shows that at the end of the episode encourage you to visit your local library to find more about X.
Reading Rainbow?
No, that is a show called Voyagers. Voyagers. Back to Tara.
Yes.
For want of a nail, Smith and Helen's true loyalties are placed on trial by an old nemesis. The BCR struggles to maintain order across the JPS. Kito is forced to confront his atrocities.
Atrocities. At first, I was like, Misfits of Science, but I don't think there's atrocities.
It was a dark show, guys.
Jesus, Smith and Helen. For want of a nail. Is this the Lone Gunman? No.
This was season 4, episode 9, starring Name of Amazon's Voice Assistant, Davalos.
Oh, the man in the high castle.
The man in the high castle is good for 1 point. You're welcome, Amazon owners. Sarah D. Bunting. City upon a hill. Ed handles a trespasser. Ellen and Deke chart a new course without mission control. City
without
upon a
mission
hill.
Control, lost in space.
Lost in space, not an alternative history show. Your clue, season 1, episode 10, aired in 2019. One of the stars, Michael Dorman. He of Patriot, if you don't know that name.
Yeah, that doesn't really help me.
That show, For All Mankind. For All Mankind. Okay.
Neat.
I watched it.
Nick, your episode is called Twin Cities. The synopsis is short and sweet. The origins of the crossing are revealed.
Twin Cities.
Twin Cities.
This is probably wrong, but His Dark Materials?
Incorrect. This was Season 2, Episode 6, aired in 2019. One of the stars was Olivia Williams.
In this peak TV era, I think this is still something I have not heard of.
I know Tara knows. Or should know.
That's Counterpart.
It's Counterpart, correct.
Probably Counterpart. The show that everyone told me to watch and I still have not watched it.
Yeah, you would like it.
Yeah, you should watch it.
All right. It is time for another score break, please, Tara.
Okay. I have 10, Nick has 7, Sarah has 6.
All right, let's get back to it. This is round 4, Arts and Literature. In this round, I will give you the name of a fictional book and its author. Note, some of these were made eventually into real book tie-ins to the show. And you just need to name the TV show the book was in.
Okay.
Make sense? Tara?
Got it.
Mm-hmm. Snow Falling by Jane Gloriana.
Villanueva, Jane the Virgin.
Yeah, there you go. All right, Sarah.
Wow, that was quick.
Good job, Sarah.
Thanks.
Marriage Vacation by Pauline Turner Brooks.
Marriage Vacation? I don't know. Jack and Jill.
That is Younger. Nick Reinwald Jones, Deal Breakers by Liz Lemon.
30 Rock.
There you go.
Thank you.
Ultimate Storm by Richard Castle.
Castle?
The Man Inside Me by Tobias Funke.
Funke.
Arrested Development.
Zap Brannigan's Big Book of War.
Futurama.
Tara. Be Your Own Windkeeper by Jennifer Millmore.
Friends.
Good one, Picky.
Sarah. God Hates Us All by Hank Moody.
Gary Shandling or Larry Sanders?
Steel Mill.
Steel Mill from Nick.
Californication.
Correct.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
Nick, The Width of Peaches by Jimmy Shive Overly.
You're the worst.
You're the worst. Correct. Nice tea.
Oh, wait, I haven't answered yet, Dave.
How dare you?
Tara.
Yeah.
Descent by Noah Soloway.
The Affair.
Scorpio by Tom Yates for Sarah.
Scorpio. I don't know. The Simpsons. Why not?
That was House of Cards. House of Cards.
Oh, right. Tom.
Last question of round 4 is for Nick. The Pepperwood Chronicles by Nick Miller.
Don't know.
That is New Girl. New Girl.
Ah.
And that is the round. Scores, please, Tara.
All right. Sarah has 7. Nick has 11. I have 14.
Well, I guess you know what that means. We're ganging up against Tara in.
All right.
Yay.
Bring it.
Answer three of these, we'll subtract two off Tara's. Manage to sweep the card, we're going to subtract four from Tara's total.
All right, Nick, let's get her.
All right, let's do this.
Classics. Who introduced his 50s sitcom co-starring his wife by saying, "I am what is known in the business as a straight man"?
Would that be Dick Van Dyke?
It's the Say Goodnight Gracie one, right?
George Burns?
Yeah.
George Burns is your answer?
Tis.
Sure.
Correct.
Yay. Good job.
Sitcoms. What sitcom usually ends with two divorced women sitting around griping about men? This is mid-90s card set, by the way. Just to...
Is that Absolutely Fabulous?
Sure.
Absolutely Fabulous is your answer?
Yeah.
Incorrect. Oh. We were looking for Kate and Allie.
Kate and Allie.
Oh, man. That thing.
Drama. How many years did Paul Bryan have left to live on Run for Your Life?
Well, I don't know.
I don't either, but one sounds nice and...
Sure. Yeah.
1 year is... Incorrect. Multiply that by two, and you have your answer. It's two.
Yeah.
Kids and Games. What Nickelodeon sitcom takes place on a teenage dude ranch?
Hey, Dude.
Sure.
Hey, Dude is correct.
Yay!
Yeah.
All right. Need one more out of these two. Stars. What Batman villain was formerly professor of Egyptology at Yale? Batman villain.
The Mummy? I don't know.
I mean, if we're talking about like 1960s Batman, there were... Because I want to say the Riddler, but...
Sure. I don't know, so whatever you feel. Right,
the Riddler.
We were talking about the 60s Batman. The villain is King Tut.
Oh.
What?
All right, wild card. Need this to subtract two points from Tara's total. What CBS news show was the only program in TV history to make the top 10 ratings list for 13 years straight?
I hope it's 60 Minutes, because...
Yeah.
60 Minutes is 60 minutes. Correct.
Yay!
Yay, says Chara. Loves it when people take points away from his total.
She's still in the lead also, so whatever.
Scores, please, Tara.
Sarah has 7, Nick has 11, I have 12.
All right. Close game. Thanks for the equalizer challenges. We are back to it. Round 5, Science and Nature. In this round, I will give you some info about a TV scientist. You name the character. Tara. He created the Thinglonger, the Who Ask machine, and the first robot capable of applying for a boat loan.
Professor Farnsworth from Futurama.
Sarah. This scientist dabbles in alternative universes, root beer floats, and enjoys the bovine company of Gene.
Oh, Gene. It's, you know, John Noble on Fringe, whose name I don't remember.
That's a problem.
Twizzlers? Anything else? Please. Oh, God, what is his name? His name is not John Noble.
Nope.
His name is Walter Bishop. Fuck.
Yes, it is.
Wow. Oh, my God.
Good. I'm buzzing on that one, too.
I was like, alternate universe. Just try to send it to you.
All right, Nick. This professor is continually breaking the same beaker.
Oh, Bunsen.
I'll give you that. Professor Bunsen Honeydew.
Bunsen Honeydew. Oh, okay.
Tara Ariano. Makes shit out of coconuts.
I don't know his name, but the professor from Gilligan's Island.
That, in fact, is his name, the professor.
Oh.
Sarah D. Bunting. Was never on a break from paleontology.
Ross Keller.
Nick Reinwell Jones. This atomic physicist specialized in the study of intrinsic fields, but his experiments left him feeling trapped and somewhat blue. Two possible answers here.
Dr. Man, John Osterman or Dr. Manhattan?
Those were the two possible answers. Thank you. Bonus points, 3 day points for the value guest there.
Hey.
What a brown noser. All right, Tara. This computer scientist gave up state secrets for a sexy lady in a red dress. This led to the decimation of his people and, naturally, him becoming president.
Jed Bartlett. I don't know.
Do I have any steel mills left?
You have one.
All right. Steel mill, Gaius Baltar.
Correct. Gaius Baltar from Battlestar.
Good job.
Sarah D. Bunting. This night shift supervisor is good with bugs and cold open quips, but bad with the ladies.
Good with bugs and cold open quips, but bad with the ladies. Night shift supervisor. Fuck. I don't know. Chuck?
Incorrect. I know all the steam mills are gone for other people, but anybody know the answer there?
No.
No.
Night shift supervisor, good with bugs and cold open quips, bad with the ladies, Gil Grissom from CSI.
Oh. He had a girlfriend.
Yeah, but he was really shy around the ladies. That was his whole thing. Well, took him a long time to get there, Tara.
True.
Nick Reinwald-Jones, last question of our science and nature category. First in science, second in command.
Spock.
Correct. And that is round 5, science and nature. Update scores, please, Tara.
All right. Sarah has 9. I have 14. Nick has 15.
All right. This is our last round coming at you. It is the sports and leisure round, everybody's favorite topic.
It's one person's favorite topic.
You like leisure? What are you talking about?
In this round, I will give you the name of a fictional game or sport played on a TV show, and you name that show.
Okay.
Tara.
Yep.
True American.
New Girl.
Sarah D. Bunting. Gale Force Winds.
Gale Force Winds?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Futurama, why not?
That is incorrect. Gale was the clue there. That was Bob's Burgers. Bob's Burgers. Nick, your fake sport or game is... Card Wars.
I have no idea.
That was Adventure Time.
Oh. Yeah. Okay. Well, I learned one thing about that show today.
Tara Ariano.
Yep.
Satan's Path.
Supernatural?
Decent guess. That is from The Simpsons.
Oh.
Sarah D. Bunting. Chardy McDennis.
Supernatural?
No, that's named after all the people from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Oh, right, sure.
Nick, Cones of Dunshire.
Parks and Recreation.
Correct. Back to Tara. Marsh Gammon.
How I Met Your Mother?
Correct. Sarah D. Bunting. Rock, Paper, Lizard, Spock.
I think it's Rock, Paper, Scissors, Lizard, Spock.
Oh, okay. That could very well be, but that's not the information I have. So.
Fair enough.
Spot?
Spock.
Spock. Okay, Big Bang Theory?
Correct.
Boom.
Flunkerton.
Oh, it sounds familiar, but I don't know.
The Office.
Yeah.
Of course.
All right. Can I quickly get the scores, please, Char?
You may. Sarah has 10 points. Nick and I are tied with 16 points.
Oh!
This is everybody's last question coming at you.
Oh, boy.
Oof.
Tara.
Yep.
Penny Can.
Cougar Town.
Putting the pressure on Nick. Sarah D. Bunting. Pyramid. Yeah.
Oh, right. Right.
The Prophet. I don't know.
Anybody?
Battlestar.
That's Battlestar, right?
That's Battlestar, yeah. All right, Nick, you need this to tie the game up.
Okay.
No pressure.
Your fake sport or game within a real show, named The Real Show, is Bamboozled. Bamboozled. Pretty famous one. Bamboozled.
The Simpsons?
Oh, incorrect. Tara, tell them what show it was.
Friends.
Friends is the game show that Joey is up for hosting.
Needed a Wicked Wango card, Nick.
All right, that's it. Regulation is done. Final scores, please, Tara.
All right. Sarah finished with 10. Nick finished with 16. I had 17.
All right, that means Tara's Tara Ariana
on the board.
Tara Ariano, you are now on the board for this season. Tiebreaker was just going to be Trivial Pursuit card, so we'll skip that for shits and giggles. So that's it. Another episode of Extra Hot Great is in the can. We stayed up all night for BBC's Dracula before going around the dial with stops at Dare Me.
How dare you?
You, Magic for Humans, Spinning Out, and Frasier, and I don't know. I'm Frasier. Nick successfully staked out his claim for Buffy versus Dracula for the no-knack. Mm. Pause for giggles and laughs and applause. Okay. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David Tickle, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
suck it,
Sarah D. Bunting.
You are strange and off-putting. Go now.
And Nick Reinwald Jones.
Suspense accent number 7.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
You are strange and off-putting. Go now.
Ha, 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 ha.